Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by PASA Sustainable Agriculture. Register now for PASA's 2024 conference in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Don't miss over 70 educational sessions on farming and food systems, plus an expansive trade show. Learn more at pasafarming.org/HRN2024.
We talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm your host, Darren Bresnitz. Happy New Year, and I know that by the time this episode airs, we will already have passed the Larry David date cutoff for saying that, but we want to wish you one. Nonetheless, we are kicking off 2024 with our good buddy, Fermin Nunez. You may know him from Suerte and Este and Bartoti. If you've been to Austin, you've seen him around. He's a great chef and an even better guy. We talk about his childhood in Mexico, learning how to cook when he came to the States, and what brought him back to Austin after his travels in Europe. It's a great conversation, and we're so excited to have him as our first guest of the year. Then we head into the archives for a live performance by Native Son, fueled by their obsession with rock legends the Rolling Stones and Velvet Underground. The quartet built an incredible following as one of New York City's best bands. They were there to celebrate their forthcoming EP, Songs Born from Love and Hate. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy Snacky Tunes here on HRN.
Running all right now, baby, trying to get it all inside your brain now. It's a reflection. Well, say this is pleasure you have got, but don't make no sense. 'Cause I get what I want right now. 'Cause I get what I want right now. To manage crumbling. Problem. Just the modern world's way that's got you gone, bringing you down. 'Cause I get what I want right now. 'Cause I get what I want right now. Step right.
Fermin, happy new year. Welcome to Snacky Tunes. It's January 2nd, which means you are the first person I'm talking to this year, and I couldn't be happier. How are you, my friend?
I'm very good, man. Thank you so much for having me. Happy new year. It is the second day of 2024.
It's wild that we're here. I'm sure you're just like me. I'm sure you did a lot of cooking and eating and sipping on New Year's. What was on your table? Were you at the restaurant? Did you have a big party? What did you do?
So this year at the restaurants, we have three. We have Suerte, we have Este, and then we have Bartotti. It was the first year in a long time that I haven't been at the pass in New Year's Eve. And it was fun. It was different. Because when we opened Este, our second restaurant, that's the moment I realized that I can't be everywhere at once. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And usually for New Year's Eve at Suerte, we would do like a special tasting menu, right? So like it was a different style menu and something that we didn't do every day. And I love being in the pass, and it was great, but it was also like, it was the hardest service that we've ever had at Suerte were on New Year's Eve, because it was a thing that we don't do every day. So this year we decided to just do normal menu with a few specials. And I coordinated with the chef de cuisines at each restaurant, and
smart.
We tried them prior to that. And now we're just kind of bouncing around all the restaurants, checking in, filling in the gaps as needed. So that was like the first year where it felt weird, where I like wasn't with the kitchen, but I was at all the kitchens. It was fun, but it was like, I was out of the restaurant by like 10 PM.
It's like you go to your clubhouses that you built, and then you go to your real house, and then you're like, yeah, I'm going to chill at home with my friends and family. It sounds pretty nice.
It definitely didn't suck. professionally, it's like, I think that's a lot of what I'm finding out now professionally. It's like, I thrive when I am needed more. Wow, that is, did you hear that?
Yes, we picked it up, but it's totally fine.
It's the washer. Do you want me to turn it off or
no, just it's fine. Keep going? Just keep going.
Well, that's funny. But yeah, at the restaurant now, it's like, I'm not on the schedule anymore. I'm not relied on the day to day until, you know, like a bunch of people get sick and then I have to jump in. So it's like,
yeah,
it's weird to be around when I'm not needed and just kind of like looking at things. And I'm getting used to that. And New Year's Eve was another way of doing that in a very special night for all the restaurants.
I mean, that's great. And especially since you can empower people and share the responsibility and, you know, pop in where you're needed, as you said, but then also let other people shine. It's a big thing. I want to go back a little bit before we talk about the restaurants, because you grew up in northern Mexico. Who did the cooking? What were some of the dishes you grew up with? Were you in the kitchen helping, or, you know, was food just a thing that was just part of daily life?
It's funny to talk about this. I grew up in northern Mexico, Torreon. Shockingly, I was a very picky eater. As a kid, I never got curious about being in the kitchen. My family loves to tell the story over every single Christmas of like, every Sunday we would like go out to restaurants after church as a family. And when we would have, a lot of friends over and family, we would go to the one Chinese restaurant in Torreon. And I hated that food. I would throw such a big fit that we would have to go to McDonald's, get a Happy Meal, and then go.
Oh, you were that kid.
Go to the Chinese restaurant. So I would like just be chill. And you know, like, I was always the kid that like when they were making picadillo at my house, I would throw another big fit if they didn't just do the ground beef with salt and pepper and set it aside and then put everything else after they set my portion aside. So it was really shocking for my family when I was like 17, 18, and I told them that I wanted to go into cooking.
I mean, that's pretty shocking that you would wind up having multiple restaurants if that was your base. Because many times you're like, well, I got the kitchen, and my grandmother cooked, and my father cooked, and the family cooked, and things like that. You know, with Texas as your northern border, because I know you went to school in San Antonio and Houston. What was your relationship with America growing up, or your perspective on it? Did you have any with it? Do you know that you eventually want to go work there, or was it just something that, you know, here's another place, just, you know, I didn't think much about America?
No, I mean, I think growing up in northern Mexico, like, it's you're so close to America mm-hmm. that you're constantly going through, you know, like, we would do as a family a trip like once or twice a year to go shopping for clothing because it was cheaper and better quality products that you would get in America. So like there was always some sort of like I was always attached to America and it was always looked upon the place that like things just run better that side of the border, you know. And then when I started getting older and, you know, because you're totally supposed to know what you want to do with the rest of your life when you're in high school and you're 17 turning 18. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I thought I wanted to pursue a career in cinematography, but I knew I had to go to college, and college in Mexico was really not like something that was in the cards for me. I don't know why. I think it's like growing up and going to the States a lot back and forth. I just looked at it as like, well, it's normal that I'm going to go to college in Texas, right? So I applied to UTSA, and that's where I actually started getting into cooking because for, you know, the later teenage years of my life, I wasn't as picky eater. I wasn't into cooking at home, but I was into eating a lot out. So what was normal to me of like eating tacos, eating barbacoa, carnitas, all those things that were just like super normal. It was fun for me to eat that. And then I go to college and I realize that I have no idea how to cook. And that's kind of like the whole cooking came together when I started like figuring out like, how do I make rice? How do I make?
Yeah. You know, all of a sudden someone isn't making it for you and you're like, oh, I miss all the food I grew up with.
That's exactly how it happened. And then
last thing my mom taught me, like the day or two before I went to college, she took me to a supermarket and she's like, here's how the melons are ripe. Here's how you shop for food. And I was like, oh, okay. That's how you pick out a cantaloupe. All right.
And it's crazy all the things that you take for granted growing up. And then when it's your time to be an adult, it's like, oh, wow, this is life. This is the rest of life.
So listen, it's one thing to be cooking for yourself, at U2 San Antonio. It's quite another thing to be like, I like it enough to go to the Art Institute in Houston. What made that jump? What was that pivotal turn for you?
So at college, I enjoyed everything about college except the studying part. I love the partying. I love the meeting people. And I quickly realized that it was like going to be the most expensive party I've ever been to.
Yeah.
And somewhere along those lines, I turned on the TV one day and Alton Brown was on the Food Network. It was a very special episode because it was a behind the scenes of how they make the show. And I didn't know what the Food Network was. I was just like, oh, this is like a show that tells you how to make shows. And then I thought that the food, like, I didn't know why I thought this, but like, I thought the Food Network was about like a behind the scenes show kind of thing. So I just kept going back to the Food Network. Then I got interested in cooking. I stumbled upon Anthony Bourdain, Kitchen Confidential. And I was like, man, this is a pirate life I've been wanting to chase. I took a job at my first kitchen job officially was at the dorm cafeteria of UTSA. And I loved it.
Get in there.
I loved it. Yeah. So then I was like, man, this is pretty cool. I'm going to pursue this as a real career. So I went to get a tour of the Art Institute in Houston. Culinary Institute of America was not in the price range for me. Mm-hmm. So I was like, let's see what are some other options. And I really loved it. And I stuck with it because for the first time in my life, it felt like I was good at something where I wasn't trying to be good at it. It was just like exciting for me to go to class and learn about stocks, learn about how to improve on my knife skills. So that was like something I was really lucky to pick up on without even knowing because school was not doing that for me ever.
You know, it's interesting because you go to culinary school and then I know you went to Europe to cook for a bit and things have changed over the years, but I have the feeling that when you were in culinary school, it wasn't notoriously focused on like European type of cooking. It wasn't very global as it's gotten more. Did you bring anything from your background or anything that you grew up with, or at least a mindset or kept it back in mind when you were cooking at culinary school or in Europe that said, this is great, but I'm going to apply it to what I know?
I think at that time, the culinary school program, it was still really focused on the European style of cooking. Yeah. And it was about to start. We were starting to get classes on like Latin America, you know, cuisines of the world and all these things. But for me, culinary school was everything was so new because I didn't grow up cooking. That it was like so interesting. Everything was just extremely new. It was like honeymoon phase to the max. Day after day. So I really enjoyed that. And because I noticed that I was good, I was a little cocky. Then I went to Europe and I just backpacked through Europe. And that's where like my ego got checked in because, when I was cooking, I realized that it's just in America that like a lot of people don't know how to cook for themselves. You know, in Europe, like when I was backpacking, I realized that the Italian guys that were staying in Barcelona at the hostel were making outstanding pasta from scratch. And like, they were not chefs and I was. So that right. was like a big reality shock for me. I was like, oh, turns out I'm not God's gift to cooking. This is just like how the rest of the world operates. And that's totally normal. So that was a big, big thing for me to realize at a young age where it was like a little bit of like, calm down for me. You are good. But like, the rest of the world knows how to cook and they don't need to be chefs.
Yeah. Could you imagine coming back home and being like, grandmama, you know, you want to make a stock this way. And they'd be like, get out of my kitchen.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. Let's take a quick musical break. And when we come back, I want to talk about your return to Texas and Austin, about that era, which I like to think of like the first generation of like the new era of dining in that town, and then the opening of your restaurants and some of the accolades that went with it. We have a song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes on HRN.
Don't you hear the water rolling down the mountain, rolling down the mountain and running to the sea? Can't you feel my heartbeat? Steady as a drum, babe. Steady as a drum, babe. I'm crawling to me. Oh, how time moves slow. And feel it in your soul. Let me hear you go. Oh, 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 oh. Don't you feel the earth?
Hello, welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We're with our good friend Fermin. And you come back from Europe, your ego's been checked, but you've also learned a lot. And you could go back to anywhere in the US and you choose to go back to Austin. And I think you come back to Austin at a pretty interesting time when the city was really starting to evolve into the dining and culinary community is today. And you worked at some great spots, Barley Swine, La Condesa, Launderette. What was the scene like then? And what made you want to go back to Austin at that time?
You know, I could have gone anywhere in the world and I chose to do Austin, right? I think the little funny background on that is the reason why I came to Austin was before I left to Europe, I said to myself, if I come back with money, it's better. It's time that I could have spent more in Europe. So I was like, I came back decidedly with like no money left over. And I did just that. And the reason why I came here is because my sister was living in Austin at the time and I needed a place to stay. So it was just like a magical time and place, like you said, in Austin. 2009, La Condesa was maybe a year and a half old. And Austin was very different back then. There was like, you know, I would say between 5-8 restaurants that were notable of what was happening in the city. Barley Swine was definitely one of them. Uchi was the place to be at. Mm-hmm. You still had to stage there for a good amount of time before you would get hired. Contigo was another one. Foreign Domestic was opening. So it was the beginning of you could see some of the big city chefs that were coming to Austin to pursue having a backyard and a little bit of a better balance in life. So I chose to go to Condesa because I had been cooking, I want to say maybe like 5-6 years of that professionally. And I never cooked Mexican food. And I thought I knew everything there was about Mexican food. And I just applied to Condesa knowing that it was going to be like, or thinking that it was going to be a super easy job to have because it was like the ingredients that I knew. And I quickly realized that I wasn't. But I loved being there because it showed me the true way of having the soul and heart of a grandmother cooking Mexican food, but with the technique and the expertise of a chef that has been trained. And it brought everything together for me where I was excited and rediscovering my cuisine through the lens of Rene Ortiz, who is an incredible chef. He has an amazing palate. Mm-hmm. And I spent a good amount of time there. I climbed through the ranks. I made a really good lasting friendships from that place. And then after that, I went to Uchico for a little bit. I said, let's switch it up. Let's learn something completely different. In the meantime, too, I was staging at Barley Swine. Barley Swine was a place that I always wanted to work. I would go there on my days off to stage. But it was like, I always say that Bryce Gilmore is truly the chef that taught Austin how to cook and how to, most importantly, source. He started from a trailer where it was truly farm to trailer cooking. And not a lot of people were doing that. You would see restaurants that were like getting some ingredients to run their restaurants with local farmers. But Bryce was the guy that was like, we only have Texas ingredients. And it was also a time in place where restaurants of like, they didn't have to be so big. They didn't have to have, you know, over 100 seats. And you were starting to see chefs not where chefs goes. And the kitchens were starting to be open. And you would see on menus, substitutions politely decline. And you would see communal seating, right? And then it was also the first place where you would see on a menu where kitchen for the beer is $1. So it was a very
I tipped quite a few kitchen beers in my day at Barley Swine.
Totally. And there was something magical happening. Yeah. Right? And it was so magical that nobody would ever quit. So the best thing you could do is go there and ask them to stage for free once a week or as often as you could. And that was just a magical time in Austin where it truly like I remember the first time I had a Barley Swine, I was like, we all get broccolini. Like, how is he turning into like this beautiful thing? And I'm just like grilling it and putting, you know, like Mexican Romesco on top of it at La Condesa. I was like, he really showed Austin what you can really do. If you like just get into it. And that was a magical time and place. And I think he really like developed a lot of what Austin is like now.
Yeah. I mean, he really embraced Texas ingredients and culture through his own lens. And I know that it was around this time where you started thinking about like your own lens and what's it mean to have your own restaurant. And, you know, look, I've poured enough queso into my body for a lifetime. And Tex-Mex is obviously really big in Austin and around town. But what was the city's relationship with more authentic, more regional Mexican food? Was it even really popular? Or was it just a couple of like the older, maybe not as popular restaurants with like the mainstream dining community? You know, could it even be an option to open up a new sort of type of dining experience in Austin?
I mean, at that point in regards to like Mexican food,
yeah,
you said it best. It was like, I don't think Suerte would have survived if we would have opened, you know, around that time. I think also that was also when a lot of more people were putting attention to Austin, but not as much as they are now. And I think the time it really changed, it was when people starting to believe in what was happening. And it also like, I think to me, the biggest thing in Mexican food is the masa. And that is like the canvas of what a great Mexican restaurant can be. And at the time there was only a few places that were doing it and not a lot of them were getting a lot of recognition. Fonda San Miguel has been doing it for such a long time.
I mean, that's the one that came to mind. Well, I don't want to say like no one was doing it because they're legendary, but it's a different type of restaurant. They were not getting
the recognition, you know, yeah. They were still just looked at like, you know, okay, Mexican restaurant. And Naranjo was also doing it way before Suerte opened, and it wasn't just getting that national acclamation just yet. Obviously, like she's doing really good. She has a James Beard now, so like there's a lot of more appreciation too. I think Mexican food was not what it was now back then too. You know, if I were to pinpoint a time where I saw nationally Mexican food getting a lot of recognition, I would take it back to where when Rene Redzepi decided to do a pop-up in Mexico.
Yeah.
I think that really made everybody look towards Mexico and be like, why is this guy so interested in what's happening over there, right? And I'm like, man, I love Mexican food. I think it's like the most exciting. It rivals, you know, the best sauces that you would find in fresh cooking, like a mole.
Look at
like,
any mole. Look at any grandma's mole. It's so complicated. Exactly. And no disrespect to the mother sauces or Italian sauces, but they are not as, at times, depending, again, I don't want to get in trouble here, but like, they're not as rich or as complex as something you could find at, you know, at Pujols, you know, I don't know what day it's on, 2000 de mole at this point.
Yeah.
You know, it's I'm glad it got its right and its respect. I wish it had come a little earlier than a white chef from Copenhagen coming over, but you know, look, people need people sometimes just need their eyes pointed in the right direction.
And I think that was a really good catalyst that I think started to just like point people in the right direction, you know, because sometimes you need that. And I think that's like a little bit sad about Mexican food is like we need a white guy from Europe to come and tell us that our food is great, you know?
Yeah. But he came over and then he sort of got out of the way and he moved over to, you know, to other countries. So with that catalyst, with that change, with that openness, with like the maturing of the Austin dining machine and scene itself, like when did Suerte first become an idea for you? And when did you think it could actually be a restaurant that could survive, that could actually have a chance of having a place as a restaurant?
Oh man, that's a funny thing because Suerte, I think we started talking about it in late 2016, 2017.
Wow.
Restaurants usually take shy of 2 years from when you think about them to when they actually open. We opened in March of 2018 in Suerte. There was not a lot of restaurants like it at the time. It was also the first time where myself was going to be the executive chef. I was not somebody's right hand. I was not a shadow. It was exciting, but it was also intimidating at the time. Intimidating in the way that it was just a kid, you know, that had been the right hand to some chefs that were known in the Austin industry, that was partnering up with this Jewish guy from Boston that had a dream about making great tortillas, right? So we had a lot of things to, I don't know if prove is the right word, but we didn't have the recognition that we have now. So it was a little bit scary to open a restaurant as big as Suerte was and talk about like Mexican food in a completely different way then, where every time I talked about it, I had to like explain what nixtamalization was to everybody,
right,
and explain to them
right
why we were going to do that and why it mattered, right? And then be like, yeah, it's not going to be like beans and rice for the people that didn't know our backgrounds, right? Because in the industry, like people knew who we were and people had tried our food here and there, but like you make a business out of new customers, right? And a lot of those new customers are not in the restaurant industry. So that was a little bit of like how we were thinking about, and then you had the stress of like, you started talking about this thing almost 2 years ago. And you start even questioning yourself, like, is this still relevant? Are people going to want to come in and eat this? Right. It's like, am I even excited to do it? You know? And it turns out like, yes, all those things are happening because you believe in the project. But like after talking about it and selling it for so many days before you actually even get to sell a tortilla, it's like, it can be a mind fuck, you know, for lack of better terms.
Yeah. Yeah, it's long enough to live in like your own mind and your own head and talk to people, and then you go like, "All right, this has to be a business at some point."
Exactly. So we opened Suerte, and we were lucky enough to get a good amount of national and local acclamations to come and actually enjoy what we were doing. It was such a magical point in time because it was. A lot of me still in the kitchen, the day-to-day running it, you know, and it felt really nice to like, at that time, we didn't have like fancy PR. We didn't know that writers were coming in. Like,
sure.
It was just a true restaurant that was like run with passion, and we were doing our best regardless of who was coming in. And we happened to do it right for the people that came in that we had no idea that were going to write about us, right? So that was something special. And then to answer your question, it's the moment where it felt like, okay, we got this. We're doing this right.
Yeah.
My business partner, Sam Hellman Mass, who had a background in cooking too, he got married in February 2020. Mm-hmm. And it was fireworks, man. It was like, you know, he was celebrating, you know, love in Oaxaca, got married. We were like, man, this is life, right? This is what life is all about. Like, life is smiling at us, like celebrating his marriage. The restaurant was doing good. We both of us were like in Mexico, you know, taking time away.
I love it.
We come back, and a few weeks later, we all know what happened, right? Because it was late when he got married. So he went on honeymoon. He came back, and I think after a week of him coming back from his honeymoon, we closed the restaurant for a month, right?
Wow.
So it was like that's restaurants, right? That's roller coasters, and I think it's like, you know, restaurants are you always have to have a little bit of luck, you know? Even if you do everything right, sometimes the world will tell you that it was not the right time, and then that happens, right? But now we're at a place where, like, we are stronger than ever. I feel like Swords is producing the best food it's ever had, and it's a little bit of because I'm out of the way. I'm letting the people that are focusing on just that do their roles and steering the ship, right? I always describe as like the chef de cuisines are the pilots, are the ones that are steering the airplane, and I'm the traffic control that is guiding them. I'm like, I need you to land here. I need you to go here. This is where we're going.
Yeah.
But they are the ones that are in charge because they're doing it on the day to day. And I used to be sad about me not being able to do that. But now I'm happy to see them grow and fly the plane and me just being their ear and like coach them to go where we need to go.
Yeah. I mean, having that mentality is probably what allowed you to open up Este, your second restaurant, being able to let go a little bit. But it's interesting because Suerte was pre-pandemic, Este was post-pandemic. They're both super successful. They've both gotten a ton of accolades. How have you been able to, and I understand like the work balance, but like having the restaurants exist, be their own identity, hit the same similar highs for both restaurants, opening up in two completely different culinary worlds. Like it's the pre and after. Did you do anything different for number two, or was it sort of like you just took what worked and knew what you had to refine?
I think we did a little bit of the similar things that we did at Suerte when we opened, but we also learned a lot from when we opened Suerte. Mm-hmm. And when we opened SA2, you know, we were supposed to start construction on that on March of 2020. And obviously that got delayed by a full year. So that was honestly like a silver lining for us, for me, because it gave me an extra year to truly focus on what I wanted that restaurant to be like and how to execute it and how to go about it. So it felt like versus when we opened Suerte, where it was like, man, we like nervous. I don't know. You know, like, are people going to still be excited? Where Este, I was like, I had such a clear vision of what that restaurant was going to taste like, was going to feel like, and how it was going to run. That when we opened, it felt like we had been open for a long time. It was also really different than Suerte, because at Suerte, everybody started on the same day, right? And the person that was working the grill had never worked the grill there. And I had never expoed in that restaurant before. And I had never worked with the people that had worked there in that environment. And when we opened Este, I took not everybody that was a key player at Suerte, because I didn't want to open two restaurants at the same time.
Sure.
I took some of the people that were key players that knew how I communicate in the kitchen, knew the standard. So it was like we already knew how to get the awkwardness of opening a new restaurant when you know anybody. And it felt like we had a head start to where when you actually opened it, which was like we were playing a restaurant. We were fixing the things that we were anticipating that we're going to go right. And it was like just figuring out how to like fine tune it. Right. So it was like at that point, it was more of me, like, rather than being the guy playing the guitar and singing the song, I was a producer where I was like, okay, give me a little bit more bass, give me a little bit more drums on this one.
Yeah.
You know, cause a lot of the things that we went through at Suerte, we only went through once. And we have a lot of people that have been since day one at Suerte with us or a few years into that, like, you know, if we didn't open Este, I wouldn't expect them to still work with us, because it's like, what are you going to learn here for being 5 years? You know, you got to pursue your own thing. But
yeah,
years at Suerte, like, let's open a new restaurant. Let's have a different role for you. And in that same way, too, it also opened up new roles for the people that were ready to keep growing at Suerte. So that was like something super important. I did not want to open two restaurants at once.
Right. You want to evolve. And, you know, the one thing though that I feel that does time together is when you walk into them, like the designs of the restaurant feels like they're talking to each other, the vibes and the music all feels like it's coming from, I don't want to just say your point of view, but from like a singular point of view that ties them together. Outside of the food and the drinks and things like that, what was the message? What was the mission you wanted to say with the design, with the vibe, with the music in both the restaurants and Bartoti as well?
I think like with all the restaurants, I always like to have a point of view where, you know, we work with really good people in our team. You know, Matt Garcia, who's our architect at all the restaurants, he met Sam, our business partner, playing basketball, right? And he happens to be like a really amazing local architect that doesn't really do restaurants. He mostly does houses.
That explains a lot, actually. Yeah.
Something like that. It was like, you know, we wanted to create a restaurant that it's like Suerte, its first language is English, but it's very fluent in Spanish. You know, Este is the same. They're both in Austin, Texas. They are from the mind of, you know, myself and the team and Sam and Matt, but we take inspiration by a lot of the places that we like to visit in other parts of the world, you know, and for this case, mostly being Mexico. But we never want to recreate something just because we saw it over there, because I think that's where you lose a little bit of the soul. So for me, it was like having something that's exciting for people to be like, oh, This is Suerte. You know, it's a modern Mexican restaurant that it's in Austin, and you see a little bit of the notes from Mexico, but it's not just like a Mexican restaurant in Austin. It's a it's a restaurant in Austin that happens to be Mexican, and Este tells that same story. It's a little bit of taking those notes from Suerte, but it's a little bit older. You know, maybe you take your friends to Suerte for a birthday celebration, but you know, you go to Este for celebrating engagement, right? It's like it's a little bit of like the older sister to Suerte that it still has that same soul and vibe, but maybe just a little bit like the years have been a little bit, you know, nicer to
sure
to
that sure sure. No, I get that. Before I let you go, I want to talk a little bit about your work outside of the restaurant in the Austin community, because you're pretty involved in different projects and different outreach and things like that. Look, you have a lot on your plate. You know, you have three spots. You know, you travel, you're part of festivals, you do things like that. Why be involved with the community? What's it mean to you to give back? And how is it important? How does it all tie with the restaurants and the bar?
I mean, I think it's very natural to me to make that a part of what we do, not just myself, but it's like we are restaurants in Austin. We're not chains that are coming from somewhere else to like just try to make money, right? So if we take care of the community, like that's who takes care of us. And also like if we take care of the staff that works in our restaurants, like they're going to take care of our customers, and the customers are part of the community that are supporting us. And it's just like kind of like full circle to me.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
that was one of the biggest things that I came from with the pandemic, that I only want to do the things that I believe in and support to make sure that the community keeps growing and evolving and taking care of each other. Cause I think that's just the way it should be. You know, it's like when you're in school, when you're a little kid, like they show you how everything works, and then you grow up and you kind of like forget about it and you don't do those things. But now that I have the microphone, I'm just happy to be involved with the things that I believe in and that I want to be a part of, to also set the example for the people that are in my kitchen right now cooking, that are eventually going to become chefs, and setting the standard for them on how to act and the responsibility that comes with being a chef and owning a restaurant.
It's amazing. Well, I can't say congratulations enough. I can't wait to come back down to Austin to eat with you. If people want to check out the restaurants or just see what you're up to from afar, where can they go? How can they see what you're doing?
They can check us out online. Everybody, you know, is on Instagram. So you can check out Suerte ATX. You can check out Este ATX. And you can check out Bartotti ATX as well. You'll see when we're open, you see what we're up to. If you want to see a little bit of what I'm doing on my day-to-day, Chief Nunez is my Instagram. You'll see a little bit of behind the scenes in all the restaurants and just things that I might be doing too, and events or travel and whatnot. So, yeah.
Amazing. Well, so good to sit down and chat with you. Happy to kick the year off with you. Appreciate you making the time.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. We have a song from the archives and then a live performance here on HRN.
Pass a message to you when you're a lover. Like a dirty bouquet with your wine. I'll tie to my body some roses. I will fly till I get you alive. Are you thinking of me now, Methuselah? I'm a passenger, I go along. Have you found a place that's deeper than the corners of your mind? To settle down, myself, I see lions. Lying golden on beaches of white. I see men with their boats in the weather. Carry me as I drift in the night. I don't think of you, and I'm missing you. Are you thinking of me now, Methuselah? I'm a passenger. I go on. Have you found a place that's deeper than the corners of mine? Of you, I'm missing you.
Are you thinking of me now, Methuselah? I'm a passenger. I go. Have you found a place that's deeper than the corners of your mind? Are you thinking of me now? I'm a passenger. I go upon. Have you found a place that's deeper than the corners of your mind? Settle down.
Want to cultivate farms and food systems that nourish, heal, and empower? Register now for PASA's 2024 Sustainable Agriculture Conference. Discover resources, services, and products at our expansive trade show and explore more than 70 educational sessions on climate-smart practices, food justice, soil health, and more. Featuring a dynamic lineup of speakers including Reginaldo Hasle-Marroquin, farmer and founder of the Regenerative Agriculture Alliance and CEO of Tree Range Farms, and Reverend Dr. Heber M. Brown III, pastor, community organizer, and founder of the Black Church Food Security Network. Find your community at PASA's 33rd Annual Conference in Lancaster, Pennsylvania on February 8th through 10th. Register now at pasafarming.org/HRN2024. That's pasafarming.org/HRN2024.
Welcome back. We got Native Son live here in studio on Snacky Tunes. You guys want to go around and introduce yourselves?
How's it going? My name is Danny Gomez, and I play guitar and sing in Native Son.
What's up? I'm Jake. I play guitar.
I'm Alexis. I play drums.
I am Mauricio. I play bass.
Danny, you met Jake in Florida, right?
Yeah, we've probably known each other since we were about, I want to say, like 10 or 9.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did you start playing music then, or were you just kind of admirers?
Yeah, no, we didn't really, I wasn't even playing guitar back then.
I played guitar back then, but not with
he's
Danny.
The prodigy with that, yeah.
I've played guitar for, ever since about that time is when it started.
Really? What were some of your early tunes? What were some of the bands you played or covered first? Or all original prodigy, just... music came out of you like a water out of a well.
I think like one of the first band ever like made me want to play guitar was Green Day. And then I went straight into Van Halen.
Just so we have a reference point, which Green Day record?
I mean, so American Idiot came out at that time.
Okay.
And then I went straight back to Dookie and Insomniac.
Okay, like, fair enough.
The three chord records. I mean, I learned power chords from that band.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I saw them play over the summer and they're like, for you old school fans, it was Dookie. I was like, I remember when old school was their EPs and not Dookie. So just getting a solid reference point.
Oh, man.
So you guys met in Florida and then you reconnected in New York?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
How did you, was it a bar, a venue, was it a, on the train?
I think it was my birthday, to be honest with you. We actually went out to Max Fish that night with some friends.
A mutual friend of ours who, I mean, I hadn't spoken to Danny ever since middle school. I didn't know he was out here or anything like that.
I think Jake had seen me play live a couple of times maybe.
Yeah. I did see Acid Dad. This same mutual friend had brought me. I was like, oh, we got a bunch of friends from Florida that are all hanging out. Come chill. And like, so I went and saw his old band. And then same sort of situation. He was like, oh, it's one of our friends from Florida's birthday. Like, you should come hang out with everybody. Remember everybody from middle school?
It was me.
So it turned out it was old D. Gomez.
When did you start percolating ideas to have a band? And Acid Dad, former Snacky Tunes guest, good to see you again. As always, when did you start to put together the ideas for Native Son?
Probably, I want to say last November, December. You know, I had a lot of songs that I wanted, you know, to play. So we kind of started demoing that and working on that. And that's, you know, around the time I sent them to Jake, you know, because he'd always been the best guitarist I knew growing up. And I was like, you know, we seem to be into the same stuff. So we grew up together. I feel like we know who we are as individuals. This seems like the right combo. So then we started kind of recording, and then I used to live, you know, we're college best friends, and we used to live together, and he didn't know how to play drums, and I would force him.
Who are you pointing to?
I'm pointing to Alexis over there, the beautiful he. So I would force him to play drums, and he, like, naturally always picked it up, and then, you know, it seemed natural, and we were like, you know what? You're going to play drums either like it or not. Yeah, in this band.
Did you feel that it was natural picking up drums? You're in a very safe space here. Did they force you? Did they coerce you?
No, it was cool. Because when we lived together, he would always be writing songs. And there was a drum set at my house that we were storing for a friend. And he's like, just hop on there. And then I would do it. And we kind of stopped doing that. And then when he started writing his own stuff for Native Son, he asked me to do it again. And it just kind of happened. It just kind of forced me to do it.
Do you feel like you're still learning, like, rudimentary drum stuff?
Yeah. What's a rudiment? I don't even know what that is. He doesn't play it again.
And then he moved from Mexico, from Monterrey, to Mo. I'm pointing to Mo, last member.
Yeah. Mo El Papi Martinez.
He moved here about a year and a half ago to try to do music, you know, try to do the hustle. And we, you know, through a mutual friend also kind of connected us. And here we are, as he says.
Yeah, I came here just to do music. I finished college and came here. And
you spent risked like it all, you know?
Almost a year without a band, just like trying to. I mean, I jammed with people, but it never worked out.
Right.
Like completely. And because of a friend of us, I just texted Gomez, like, hey, let's play. And he was like, yeah, I know you're a guitar player, but we need a bass. And I'm like, no worries, see you in 2 days. Yeah. I went to buy a bass next day, and I didn't need for a week, but I had a band.
What was the year that you were here without a band? Like, where were you playing? What were you doing?
I didn't play actually live, never. I'm still doing this EP by myself, acoustic, but I'm working on it and just on and off all the time. But I was just seeing bands and meeting people, and like, it's kind of hard, you know? I didn't knew almost anyone, just like almost being by myself. And yeah.
What was it about New York that drew you here? Why here, almost any other city? Or what was missing in Monterey that you thought was in New York?
I mean, Mexico is like so different. The scene and the music culture is like totally a different world. So I had lots of bands back in Mexico, but it never really like worked out completely. And I was, I don't know, the Ramones. I'm from New York, so like, yeah.
Yeah, I came because of Lou Reed.
I mean, those are both excellent answers.
Exactly.
And for the music that you were writing for this, what made it different than Acid Dad, or what did you think that you could accomplish with Native Son that you weren't doing with Acid Dad?
You know, I think this was all me and my vision and direction. I think just, you know, certain sincerity. It's kind of the music I'm working on now that, you know, fits more who I am and kind of more the vision I have for music and kind of the world.
Freedom.
When did you feel the four of you gelled as a band?
first practice.
The first practice.
Really. It was actually 4:20. First practice was 4:20.
4:20, and I met these guys the first practice. Yeah. Like, I didn't even knew them personally.
I remember.
I said, hit this man or you're out.
You're going to go back to another year in the wild. Or you're going to regret buying that bass.
I remember walking up to the practice space and just, I thought it was you. I recognized you from your mustache.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, are you Mauricio? He goes, oh, yes.
So what was the feeling? Or I mean, you all answered at the same time. What was it about that practice where you looked at each other that you didn't experience and with other bands or projects?
I mean, I just saw like real people trying to do like real music, you know, like not trying too hard.
It's interesting. I feel like it's the first time where we've actually like think as one mind and where I'm going to go next. Even someone like Alexis knows where that's going to be. You know what I mean? And it's, as you said, he's still learning and he's got the vision that where my brain would jump to next, the same way Jake does, knows how to put the sprinkles on what's missing, you know, the same way that Mo brings his swagger and dance moves to the floor.
For me, it was really simply obvious when we all played together. I mean, I grew up when I was first playing guitar, like we were just talking earlier. I played guitar and my little brother played drums. So growing up playing music, it was just me and my brother. Then, like, when I sort of grew up, went to high school, I started playing with friends, and there was friendship in those bands, but that was unique from playing with someone who is, like, family, like your brother. On that first practice with the four of us, that was the first and only time that I felt brotherhood, other than playing with my true brother.
Do you think it's because you grew up listening to the same bands, you have the same reference points, or where do you think that it comes from? And you don't, and there's no way to define it down to a science, because that's yeah, impossible, man. But where do you think it might lead from?
I think that's the best part about it. It's kind of spiritual.
Yeah. Well, with that, let's hear a song. Yeah. What are you going to play for us first?
This is the first song we ever put out. It's called Palindrome. It's about anxiety and paranoia in the city. I know you see them. You've been running all right. Now baby, trying to get it all inside your brain now. It's a reflection. They say this is pleasure you have got, it don't make no sense. 'Cause I get what I want. It's alright.
Palindrome was on the Glass Note Records Noteworthy One comp. We also had Grimstreaker and Thick in here earlier.
Oh, sweet.
How did that come about? How did you get on the comp? What's the story?
So we played Northside Fest. I think it was like our actual first real show at our Wicked Lady, and one of the A&R people for Glass Note was at the show. And she heard us play this song, actually, which we hadn't recorded for the EP at the moment. So she was like, you guys should record that song, and we'd love to have you on the, you know. So we rushed in a week and about and did two songs off the EP in that week just to kind of capitalize on things. And, those were the, you know, that got put out right away, like a few weeks after that.
We played the show, and I think the song, like the songs were due for the Noteworthy project like a week and a half later.
iPhone demo of ours from our practice space in like the Glassman office, and we're like, all right, yeah, they recorded for real.
Yeah.
We'll get them.
And did you have to go? Did they record it for you? Did you have to go? You're like, yeah, we'll be back. Yeah, we're just finishing it up. And you're like, we need to find a studio.
They should have. They should have, but they did not.
We just went back to the studio. We were recording our EP at. And just said, we need to do another song in 2 days. And we did it in 2 days.
Great. Can we hear another song?
Yeah, sure.
What are you going to play for us?
This next song is called Sister.
Here we go, live on Snacky Tunes.
I'd like to dedicate this song to Don Pedros. This song is about, some of the crazy individuals that used to inhabit that bar.
The corner, that's where I'll be, trying to find what I don't need. The girls were strutting on down the street, heaven was calling, but they found me. But not for prayer. You'll never miss her.
Debut AP came out on the 17th. which as of this time was 2 days ago. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Songs Born from Love and Hate. Where'd the title come from?
Leonard Cohen.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Tell me about it. How was the recording process? Where did the genesis from the songs come from? What were you trying to tell with this EP?
Well, you want to start with this one?
Yeah, I mean, the songs came together over a span of time, and I think they were born and then evolved as our friendship and soon-to-be brotherhood evolved. From there, I mean, to go what I've heard Danny say before and what I feel Danny say in the songs, this collection of songs is for the listener and for the musician that doesn't have a voice that is heard in music today, especially bands coming out of New York City, bands coming out of Brooklyn. This isn't for indie privileged white kids telling the story of, oh man, I didn't feel like getting out of bed today, so I made a painting. This is about the struggle of the common individual, all of these songs.
You know, it's, you know, the things have gotten pretty bland, so, you know, I think, you know, this is just an introduction of all the worlds we could go into. But I think, you know, making a mission statement of, you know, trying to kind of bring, you know, rock and roll in a sense back to the people, you know, the proletariat, trying to bring it back to a certain, you know, kind of humbleness, but at the same time, sincerity, you know, which I think has kind of been missing for a bit, especially in a place like New York. It's just, you know, so many bands just that, you know, you wonder, is really the music the first thing on the list, or is it, like, as Jake says, number five?
Yeah.
So you're calling out to question that if music really is the reason why they get out of bed in the morning, if art is really the reason they get out of bed as opposed to other things, and then you're like, I'm an artist too.
You know, as we said, we're all clear examples of that, but, you know, it's really, you know, do or die kind of thing. You know, he could be, you know, in Mexico having, you know, kind of, you know, more comfortable, you know, lifestyle, but risks it all and, you know, washes tables to be able to try to, you know, fight for his dream, which is something that, you know, some of our families, you know, as I'm a first generation immigrant, you know, Alexis is second generation, you know, Jake's from Florida, where it's like, you know, you live with that every day.
5% Cuban.
You know,
it's, yeah, I'm an eighth Cuban.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. You know, so we're really, you know, doing something for the, you know, for the first time, and I think that's what gives us kind of the fresh look. It's not, you know, it's a sort of, you know, by exploring new things that have never been done before in your family and your lineage, I think it opens up kind of a different world where it's not the same recycled garbage. You know, it's a, you know, fresh outlook on things.
And you wrote the songs, and you mentioned that they evolved as your brotherhood deepened. How did they evolve both from the concept and the music to, you know, what parts did the rest of you bring to the songs that where they ended up?
Well, you know, Danny brings to the table so much. He brings what I always see to be the skeleton, the framework, the general vibe, the mood, the attitude of the song. And then we color it in with our individual flavor. Mo brings, I mean, literally a flavor to every single song that I could never do myself. I add my personal influence, whether, like, Danny's right, sister is about Don Pedro and his experiences at that bar. I brought what I was feeling from the mood of that song, sort of angst and frustration at the loss of an establishment that meant so much to me. Wasn't necessarily my influence on that, wasn't necessarily Don Pedro specifically, but that same attitude and mood and feeling and emotion that I had when we were writing and recording that song is present in the song. And the same goes for Alexis and Mo.
Yeah, like Alexis is, for example, you know, I always make fun of him, and, you know, I say, you know, he does, my favorite drummer, for example, is like Charlie Watts from the Stones. He knows it's nothing complicated, it's just tasteful when you have to be. And Alexis, you know, by, you know, recently getting into things, he doesn't overdo things, but instead keeps the beat and keeps it, you know, keeps the groove going, and then does the tasteful, you know, simple things when they got to be done. So, you know, all those parts combined, you know, seem to have worked out.
And you guys have been playing around city just a little bit, babies.
Yeah, about, I would say,
rough
since,
trade.
Since June.
Since June. Where you guys have shows coming up next?
We've got one show left for the end of the year. So we played on Thursday with Dreamwife, who are coming over from the UK. And then we're playing in on December 10th with this band called QTY at Babies All Right as well.
Love it. Love Babies. Yeah. Love those guys.
Yeah.
Good guys.
Good guys. But yeah, no, we're starting to get, you know, some busy stuff going on for early next year.
Anything you can share or just leave it to mystery?
I'll leave it to the new year mystery.
Okay. Well, we want to make sure we have time for one more song, but where can people find you, get the EP, hit you up?
Everywhere that you can get music, it is up now. And, you know, to leave you with a little less mystery, where, you know, our EP came out on Friday and we started recording the next one on Saturday, yesterday, so.
Perfect.
You know.
Perfect. Shout out to the label, Paper Cup.
Yeah, shout out to Paper Cup, Windia Records, our label in South America.
Magnus,
Eric.
That boy.
And actually, you know, on that note, we're going to leave you with a song that, you know, we have been working on.
Yeah.
Well, great. Well, thanks for tuning in. Big shout out to the Hot Ones and Complex Con. Thanks for joining us. We're going to be off next week for Thanksgiving. And then we'll be back.
Woo!
With two more episodes before the end of this season. Season 9 of Snacky Tunes.
Wow.
I know. That's what I said.
Brother. That's amazing.
Thanks.
Congrats to you.
Thanks. What's the name of the song you're going to take us out with?
This song is called 11th Street.
Awesome. Well, thanks for listening. We're off next week, and we'll see you in a couple weeks.
Snacky Tunes is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.
Subscribe.